Okay, last panel, we have to go quickly because we have to be done by 4:45. First paper by Hilary Silver, Immigrants in Berlin. Hilary and I were in touch over Skype, and I spoke to her in German. She didn't recognize my German when I was asking her about the immigrants in Berlin, but that's okay. Andy and Claire will talk about ordinary lives in South Africa. And Maria and Michael will talk about community attraction and avoidance in the city of neighborhoods and its suburbs, a paper that I can assure you deals directly with a lot of interesting issues about neighborhood, ethnicity, race, and how people make choices. So, on that note.
Congratulations, Tony, on a great conference. Thanks very much for having me. I'm going to burn through a lot of these slides because I know that my how do you launch the show?
I'm sorry. Over to the left.
Here?
From
this
the
one?
Beginning.
From the beginning?
Right there.
There you go. I'm going to burn through a lot of these slides, so let me just tell you the structure of the paper that I hope to offer. In keeping with the theme of great cities, ordinary people, many people in Germany would argue that Berlin is its first city. That is debatable. There are many. It's a relatively flat urban hierarchy. Nevertheless, the new capital, the newly reunited capital of Germany, certainly is making a bid for world city status. And this is, rather than spend a lot of time talking about Berlin, I'm sure many of you are familiar with it, I want to skip ahead to the actual research that I was doing. I want to talk about integration and discrimination in two neighborhoods within Berlin, and particularly what I discovered from talking to ordinary Berliners, particularly the migrants who live there. And it's this contrast between the high politics of immigrant integration that has recently undergone reform in Germany and what is actually happening on the ground in terms of integration. It's that tension between the two that I hope to highlight in the paper. Officially, Germany not only has an integration policy, which it has just begun to actualize in across all of the federal states since 2008, but it also has at the level of states a set of integration policies, and then at the level of the city there's also integration policies that take place at the ward or district level, the level of the Bezirk. So within neighborhoods that I'm studying are nested within at least three levels of integration policies. And the question of how these are actualized on the ground is really what interested me. There's a whole sociology as well of the concept of integration. The idea was raised in the last panel, and I was sort of demurred about whether I ought to ask Japonica what it means to integrate in some of these communities compared to what it means to integrate in an ethnic sense, the way immigrants integrate. Maybe we can talk about that term, but certainly there's a wide range of sociological nuances and theories of integration, really going back to the classics, and I don't want to bore you with that in my 15 minutes. Rather, I want to focus on what ordinary people have to say about integration, and so let me just show you World City Berlin here and burn through my many slides that I've just told you about. I should tell you that Germans are so preoccupied with integration partly because they're concerned with social control. You know, Germany is a place that can blow apart at any time. You remember the Weimar Republic, well, they do too. And on the left, there continue to be lots of tensions because of high immigrant unemployment. This, as you can see, this summer there was a big demonstration in front of the Nikon Rathaus, and this big sign says, "Do you want it to happen here? What happened in the Paris suburbs, for example?" So on the left, there's the potential of a lot of explosions. And at the same time, there continues to be a lot of neo-Nazi activity that takes place, particularly in the eastern districts of the city. And so there is a concern that there's always the potential for extremism. And so politicians in the center often emphasize integration as a form of social control. And I should say that this goes on at the level of high politics. This gentleman here, if you're not familiar with him, is Teo Sarrazin. He wrote a book just last year, barely a year ago, Germany Does Away With Itself, in which he more or less took over the mantle of the German Charles Murray, which is to say he made the argument that immigrants were diluting the human capital, if you will, of the German nation. And they had a lot of social science to back it up, including the OECD PISA study showing that immigrants in Germany were actually doing rather poorly in school, and in fact the second generation was doing even worse than the first. So the chancellor has basically felt that multiculturalism has utterly failed, and immigrants have to do more to integrate. And the emphasis, the number one emphasis in Germany has been on learning German, and so it has a very strong cultural valence to it. Today, most politicians at the center talk about how integration is a two-way street. They more or less accept the idea that integration means their obligations on one side, to learn the language, to get a job, to be self-sufficient, to educate their children, and on the other side, for the government to provide various benefits to make that possible. Okay, that's the introduction. Now, what I want to suggest is that, in contrast to many of the high-level statements, pronouncements about integration, that in fact we really should think about also what's going on at the ground level, and for that I have been conducting field work. One of the things we know about studies of attitudes from ethnic and racial sociology is that increasingly it's normatively unacceptable to express racial animus, and that they're therefore either develop code words or they're developed. It's difficult to trust research, what people actually express when they talk about these things. And so with Philomena Essed, I borrowed her idea of everyday racism, and I think racism is probably a bad word to use in the context of Germany because it has many layered and historical connotations. But everyday exclusion certainly is a notion that we can work with to look at how routine, recurrent, and cumulative practices shape daily attitudes and the reverse. So here I am doing my field work in a local association with my Brown students, visiting my assistant. And we were doing comparative research in two neighborhoods there. These neighborhoods are districts, one in the east and the north there on the right-hand side, number, 11. And on the western side of the city, number 08, as you can see, a very big difference in the percentage of foreigners. Nikon is an area that has over 160 nationalities, about one-fifth of whom are Turkish. But it's actually also, unlike Kreuzberg, an enclave with many Arabs, and so You see many refugees from the Lebanese war. Most recently, the new group arriving are Roma. So there are a lot of different groups. The refugees include also, of course, ex-Yugoslavians, as they're referred to, some of whom are Muslim and some are not. In the eastern district of Lichtenberg, there are also enclaves of immigrants. Many people say, what are you studying immigrants in Lichtenberg for? Because it's only 2 to 3% people who are foreigners. But in fact, there are some areas of large numbers, enclaves, if you will, of repatriates from East Europe and the former Yugoslavia, but also a large enclave of Vietnamese immigrants who came from the Republic of Vietnam during the 1970s and 80s, and before the wall came down. And they were contract workers who remained in the East. So these are some of the... This is the... How much time do I have? These are some of the... 10 minutes, cool. Oh, now I can relax. The differences, as you can see, in the housing stock. Neukölln began as a small village called Rixdorf, but it also is home to a lot of Russian immigrants who live at the edge. Walter Gropius designed this Gropiusstadt, and this is where I did my field work, primarily in the neighborhood of Rolberg. It's very well known for its high crime rate as well as large numbers of immigrants. And therefore, the police keep a close watch on the area, both for because of their concerns about terrorism, but also because many of the Arabs who live there are in a particular status called Doldung. They're tolerated. Their asylum applications were rejected, but they were not deported, which means they don't have full rights. And because they don't have full rights, they get into the drug trade. There are a lot of mosques. People spend their time in mosques, both men and women. They have little shops associated with them. As you can see, a lot of them are in the backs of these courtyards. You go through there on the right side. There's a shop, and then you go all the way through, and you get to this lovely mosque that's been renovated. But nevertheless, you think it, you know, it's become sort of a symbol for being a Muslim ghetto, a parallel society. But in fact, Neukölln is very multi-culti, and the north, where many of the Muslims live, is also undergoing gentrification. And there are lots and lots of artistic industries and art galleries and so forth in the neighborhood. Here you can see some Turkish girls rapping this summer. And in Lichtenberg, a similar kind of thing can be found. Here in the east, you can see again Plattenbauen. Here are these tall high-rises finished just before the fall of the Berlin Wall, and yet a Vietnamese dragon dance going on in the shadow. Hohenschönhausen, which is the part of the neighborhood where I did my field work, was also known as the home of where the Stasi lived. This is the main prison for political prisoners during the GDR period. You can see it's closely integrated right into the neighborhood. And this is the Berger Initiative, where I did my research in this neighborhood. And this organization was a self-help organization formed when the wall came down to protect Vietnamese immigrants from racist violence that broke out against them in the early 1990s. You can see, very multi-culti. Here you have some Syrian kids rapping away and a very multicultural crowd watching. Both neighborhoods have strong and visible ethnic enclaves. Indeed, immigrants have higher self-employment rates than Germans do, not surprisingly, because they have higher unemployment rates as well. But they imprint themselves on the local landscape. This is always really interesting to me. When I found this place, it blew me away. There's a wholesale market for Vietnamese for Vietnamese businesses all over town. And this, I thought at first it was only going to be for restaurants, but it turns out the Vietnamese are getting into nail salons now too. So even in these areas of ethnic spatial concentration, it's important to point out that there are differences within the nationalities. The Turks and the Arabs don't like each other. The Turks and the Kurds don't like each other. They go to separate mosques. And similarly, the Western Vietnamese who live in the west of Berlin, they came from the south. They're boat people, middle class. They don't have much to do with the Vietnamese in the east because they're all secular communists who won the war. In addition to all of my field work there and interviewing a lot of elites, particularly association leaders, I also did a survey this summer of over 200 residents and shopkeepers. And I'm happy to talk to you about the methods, but I'd rather tell you about the results. This is sort of hot off the press. The survey found that there's a number of relationships. For example, immigrants who feel integrated, who report themselves feeling integrated, are more likely to have German best friends. The more their best friend, the larger the share of their best friends are German. So it's a contact hypothesis that seems to be confirmed. But I was actually quite surprised that there was no difference between living in the East, which is a no-go area full of neo-Nazis and is homogeneously German, and the ethnic ghetto, the parallel society that Nikon is. That's my model. The only variable that's really significant are friendships. I also ask people, you know, what does German mean to you? We got into some interesting stereotypes as a result. Most people say Germans eat a lot of Wurst. You know? If you're Muslim, you don't want to eat a lot of Wurst, I'm sure. But, you know, it's kind of interesting if you ask people, do you feel German a little, a lot? Do you feel German, yes? Do you feel German a little? Do you feel German a lot? You can see that most of the people who are immigrants are sort of ambivalent about their identities. Here, too, I found surprisingly little difference in feeling German. Where I did find a neighborhood difference was in reports of discrimination, and that's what I want to focus on for the rest of the time I have, all 5 minutes of it. The immigrants in the East, surprisingly, reported less discrimination, and there was very little I could do in the regression analysis to change that. The result was not due to the different ethnic composition I controlled for ethnicity, and it had nothing to do with it. The only other thing that explained it, besides where people lived, was whether they were married and had children. And so I've been mucking around in my qualitative data, particularly the open-ended questions, to figure out what it was, what might be responsible for this. And what I discover is that regardless of one's nationality or neighborhood, people have gone through certain kinds of common experiences of discrimination. And this is more or less what they report. On the positive side, only about half of the people have reported an experience of discrimination. And most of them who encountered it said it was rare. They, in spite of all of the no-go area rhetoric, violence was exceptional, and they rarely mentioned institutional discrimination. However, that may account for why the number of children had an effect, because there were some very poignant stories about how teachers misunderstand them, how social service agencies have no intercultural competence and things of that sort. And so it may be that having a large family where you come in contact with these institutions may explain why discrimination experiences were reported. On the negative side, however, it was the interpersonal everyday exclusion that was repeated over and over again. Particularly in the East, but throughout the city, but particularly these name-calling by complete strangers was common, where xenophobic epithets were frequently just hurled at people outside their car doors or walking in the supermarkets if you just happened to bump into them or something. It was particularly the Arabs and Vietnamese who reported this. And they often said it happened when I was in this place, usually in the East. Respondents also detected various forms of physical aversion, which they reported as forms of discrimination. For example, in public space and on the subways, people would literally, they would say, people got up and moved from sitting next to me on the subway so they wouldn't have to touch me. Other people, some of the women who wore headscarves reported similarly being jostled because they knew they cared. One person said, I was often reminded I'm not from here, and I was given the feeling of not belonging here either. So when you start to inquire about how people feel German, sometimes they blame themselves. They say, well, we don't speak German very, very well, and when we speak German, then we're okay. Others emphasize, in line with reactive ethnicity, how they're developing family values, how they have family values, and the Germans don't have family values of various kinds, right? That their idea of living in an apartment is that an individual should live alone. So if you're 35, you should be living outside your family, you know, whereas we Vietnamese, we Arabs, we live together in extended families. So what you find is that, or talking about how I'd never have a girlfriend who's German, you know, she would be unfaithful. His girlfriend's Polish. Similarly, they don't identify with Germany being their homeland. Rather, they talk about how Germans are cold, just like the weather. They don't have the warm emotions of Asians. Germans are unfriendly. All my friends are foreigners. Germans aren't friendly. They're cold. They're cool. It's a common theme. A Congolese journalist even proposed a song. He composed a song that he's recorded. There are a lot of musicians all over Berlin, just like in Nashville, I should add. This song, of course, in French, tell me about your life in your country. Tell me about those. Tell me what you like. Tell me where you come from. Tell me what you want. Tell me what you think. Tell me what you're looking for. Tell me what you do. Tell me what you see. Tell me what you believe. It's a song by a refugee. Everyone I meet wants to know where I'm from, he said. Germans are strange like that. They have their own way of doing things. They're suspicious of strangers. It's really hard to integrate, and it's easier to have friends among artists and musicians. So as you can see, there's a lot of interpersonal rejection. Only some of it is racialized. I found that a particular refrain of racialization was among Turks and Arabs, where they don't refer to skin color. They refer to color of hair. It took me a while to learn that. You do interviews with people, and like, well, what happened in your job interview? Oh, I have black hair. That was an answer. Like, I should understand it. That if you have black hair, you're racialized, you're rejected. Similarly, the idea of being socially integrated is not the same thing as having an ethnic nationality. In Germany, being German is something about descent. It's understood in racial terms. So I have to finish. Here are my conclusions. Did I do it? German admonitions for immigrants to integrate tend to ignore the everyday exclusions in everyday life that make it so difficult and humiliating to do so. And while this may flirts with journalism to a certain extent, because it does make a policy point, I think it's worth emphasizing. I think that not enough Germans realize that interpersonal exclusion has a major impact on people's ability to integrate. And second of all, I think that it's useful for sociologists to think about integration in a more relational and contextually embedded way when they talk about integration and exclusion.
Okay. I'd like to begin just by adding my thanks to both Don and Santatoni for inviting Andy and I to participate in this fabulous conference. And I also just want to add that Andy and I are actually going to split the time, so when I'm done, he's going to come up and finish the presentation. So, in post-apartheid Johannesburg, one of the most deeply divided and unequal cities in the world, the lives of ordinary people are marked by tremendous insecurity. Poor black South Africans live precarious lives in spaces of abandonment on the margins of the metropolis. They navigate pathways through a world without steady employment, formal housing, adequate health care, or basic services. The South African elite, still predominantly white, live in luxurious suburban homes surrounded by militarized walls, protected by private security, and filled with a racialized fear of crime. The everyday lives of the wealthy are largely confined to an archipelago of enclosures, from fortified suburbs to employment compounds to securitized leisure spaces, the visual markers which epitomize the pervasive insecurity felt by the elite. In this paper, we analyze the relationship between the increasing precariousness of the urban poor and the sense of insecurity of the South African elite. In doing so, we highlight the immense legacy of apartheid, the brutality of neoliberal restructuring, and the continuing significance of race in shaping ordinary life in the post-apartheid era. I've been conducting ethnographic, qualitative, and archival research in two squatter camps outside of Johannesburg since 2004, Solplaki and Lali. My book project focuses on the devastating effects of the AIDS epidemic amongst the urban poor, so it addresses the links between neoliberalization, informalization, and health vulnerability. Due to time constraints, I'm simply going to provide you some snapshots of the precarious nature of daily living in South Africa's urban slums, especially for those who are dealing with HIV and AIDS. Residents of squatter camps have by far the worst disease burden and mortality rates in the country. This is because environmental and social conditions increase vulnerability to disease and ill health. Water is often contaminated, informal electricity sources like paraffin cause pollution and congestion, lack of sanitation leads to higher exposure to opportunistic infections, and extreme heat and cold due to lack of proper shelter has a profound effect on people with compromised immune systems. The increasing privatization of social services, from housing to water, electricity, and education, exacerbates these conditions. In addition, lack of social cohesion and trust leads to amplified precariousness, as social networks and bonds of reciprocity are constantly threatened. Violence and competition are common, and certain forms of informal health care, like indigenous and faith healing, as well as home-based care, rely on strong senses of community solidarity. In 2005, it was estimated that informal settlements had HIV prevalence rates twice as high as formal urban settlements. Again and again in interviews, when I ask people why community members do not use condoms or avoid multiple partners, despite the fact that they're well educated on HIV transmission and watch their community members die on a daily basis, the reply was, well, many people think that HIV might kill them in 10 years, but poverty or violence will kill them first, so why worry about it? People are dying all the time in my community, so many people just accept that as, you know, their future. So they aren't careful about HIV because they expect to die anyway. They don't care what kills them. People have reached a point where they aren't afraid to die. Informal settlements are characterized by not only high levels of unemployment, but high levels of abject poverty. In South Africa, a person who lives on less than $62 per month lives below the poverty line. But a household is considered indigent if it survives on $269 per month. According to a community participatory research survey I conducted in both communities in the summer of 2009, 90% of households in Solplaki and 80% of those in Lali are indigent, and the average amount of money each person lives on is far below the poverty line. This is just some information for you to look at while I finish. From my field research, I found that the provision of antiretroviral treatment, which is the biomedical treatment for HIV, is often undermined by community members' unemployment, the paucity of social welfare grants, and a subsequent inability to access nutritious and sustainable food sources. People's living conditions are absolutely insecure, which makes taking drugs that require a strict time regimen, access to clean water and healthy food, and support from family members and healthcare professionals extremely difficult and often overwhelming. As one of my respondents explained, quote, I don't even know when I'm going to have a healthy meal from one day to the next, so how can I take these antiretrovirals when I can't afford to eat right? In addition, because informal settlements are generally geographically isolated and thus far removed from formal healthcare, Travel to clinics and hospitals is both time-consuming and expensive. Transportation costs are so prohibitive that for many informal settlement dwellers, the cost is only worth paying if their condition is immediately life-threatening. However, HIV-infected informal settlement residents who take antiretroviral treatment are required to visit the doctor once a month to receive a new supply of medication and to have their CD4 and viral load measured. This next story shows the incredible obstacles people must confront in their daily attempts to stay compliant with their medications, despite the structural conditions in which they live. It also illustrates the very precarious nature of having to travel from an informal settlement to a formal township. Sandra is originally from Zimbabwe, and she has faced horrific xenophobia and HIV-related stigma in Lali. Sandra's husband bought them a plot of land in Lali in 2000, but he then passed away in 2002. She did not know her own status until 2008 when she got extraordinarily sick and almost died. Even though she's not a South African citizen, she was put onto the antiretroviral program, but she's not eligible to receive social welfare and therefore has no income to support herself and her two children. Here's the story she told me. I had an ordeal last month because I didn't have money for transport to go and fetch my treatment. I woke up very early at around 4:30 so that I could walk, because people normally walk across this empty field if they don't have money for transport. It takes people 1 hour to walk, but it takes me two because I have this serious pain in my feet. So as I was walking and approaching, there's a dam, and then four men actually came from the field and they raped me. And they all slept with me. I think it happens quite often because before my ordeal, a lot of people had already reported that these incidents were happening, especially around that road. The material insecurity of South Africa's poor is a result of the entrenched legacy of apartheid and the retraction of the economy and the state, which has marked the neoliberal era. But in addition to these forms of insecurity, the poor are unable to assume the responsabilized forms of behavior required of them to access their citizenship rights. Social welfare grants, as well as healthcare provision, and especially the provision of antiretrovirals, come with certain behavioral requirements which are very difficult to comply with in squatter conditions. Citizenship itself has therefore become precarious in nature in the post-apartheid era. While it is absolutely essential to illustrate the ruthless and monolithic nature of the structural obstacles people living in informal settlements must face on a daily basis, I certainly don't want to suggest that the people with whom I work are without agency or that they only exist to survive. Their daily trajectories reconfigure markets of exchange, circuits of care, and the boundaries of the polis itself. With growing inequality, the informalization of the economy, and the devastation wrought by AIDS, people's subjectivities have been destabilized, but they are also fighting back, forging new social movements and engaging in spontaneous uprisings. In the end, then, the South African poor continue to get by, to ukupanta, as they say, and in so doing, they forge new senses of belonging and new communities while they struggle for life.
Hi, everybody. I'm going to pick up right there by talking about the insecurity of the elite and the discourse of black crime. The insecurity of the South African elite is rooted in the history of settler colonialism and racial capitalism. White fears of the black majority contributed to the formation of apartheid policies such as influx control, pass laws, and bantu stamps. And the apartheid state guaranteed political power for white South Africans, while racial Fordism ensured that they had access to social welfare and well-paying, steady jobs. But the transition of the 1990s generated new anxieties for the South African elite, for white South Africans in particular. Neoliberal democracy has not only eliminated state support for white supremacy, it's also undermined welfare, wage labor, and community solidarities, and generated uprisings and social movements that threatened the stability of the post-apartheid state. In this context, the specter of black crime has become a focal point for the anxieties of the South African elite. White South Africans are beginning to learn the language of colorblindness, and the recoding of blackness as criminal has been central to the rearticulation of race in the Rainbow Nation. Stories circulate rapidly in the public sphere of violent assaults, carjackings, home invasions, and rapes, and the perpetrator is invariably black, a black male in particular, and stories about black attacks on white victims receive the most hype, turning all Africans into potential criminals. race acts to intensify anxieties about the brutality of life in post-apartheid South Africa. Now, by any standards, crime statistics in South Africa are frighteningly high. But as Jean and John Komaroff point out, there's a particular obsession with crime statistics in South Africa. This fascination intensifies the perception of a society under siege, and more specifically, a white society under siege. This is evident in the widespread tendency to disbelieve statistics demonstrating a decrease in crime. Police statistics show that the rates of most violent crimes peaked in 2003 and have been declining since that time. Victim surveys suggest that the peak may have occurred as early as 1998. Despite this decrease in criminal activity, the perception of insecurity continues to rise. These surveys also demonstrate that the fear of crime varies inversely with the actual risk of violence. The statistics are from 1998, which is at the height of this period that was seen as a crime wave. Black South Africans are disproportionately affected by violent crime. Nevertheless, they express the least fear of violent crime, while whites and the so-called Asian or Indian population have the greatest fear. This is especially true when it comes to racialized, sexualized anxiety around rape. Although the vast majority of victims of rape are poor black women, white South Africans consistently express more fear of rape than any other group in South Africa. The racialized discourse of crime has contributed to the withdrawal of the South African elite, white and black, to a world of walled enclosures. In the wealthy northern suburbs of Johannesburg, private homes are surrounded by enormous brick walls that are armed with metal spikes and razor wire, motion detectors and video cameras, electric wires, guard towers, attack dogs, and other weaponized accessories. Each of these walls also displays the sign from a private security company hired to deploy an armed rapid response unit in case of intrusion. Among white South Africans, there exists a strong, racially informed perception that the ANC government is either incapable of controlling crime or unwilling to protect white people. They have turned to private security companies for protection. Private security has been the fastest growing industry in South Africa since the 1980s. Now employing over 470,000 people, 5,000 private security companies provide security guards, armed rapid response teams, and other security services to those who can afford them. At the annual meeting of a residents association in the northern suburbs, the director of one of the largest private security firms in Johannesburg explained quite frankly, quote, "We are a legalized vigilante service. We are a legalized mafia. You pay us, and we give you protection." In 1993, residents' associations in Johannesburg's northern suburbs began requesting permission from the city to erect gates around entire neighborhoods. Other residents' associations began building gates and posting guards without consulting the council. By 2002, over 300 roads had been closed in Johannesburg, although only 79 applications had been filed and only 23 had been approved. Private security guards are stationed at the entrances to gated neighborhoods, and vehicles branded with the logos of the private security companies patrol the streets, watching for suspicious behavior, waiting for an emergency call, and hoping that their presence alone will prevent crime or at least displace it to a neighborhood that has not yet purchased coverage. And they're pretty explicit about that. Although the owners and the managers of the private security companies are predominantly white, almost all of the security guards and rapid response teams are black, not to mention the construction crews that build the walls ever higher. In addition, most suburban residents employ black landscapers and domestic servants. The presence of black workers in white space is therefore absolutely necessary, but carefully regulated. Security companies have GPS devices in their cars so that they can track their rapid response teams to ensure that they are actively patrolling their assigned neighborhoods. And although people may trust their own domestic workers, narratives about burglaries often involve facilitation by a treacherous black cook or gardener. To address this concern, most residents' associations now have auxiliary domestic watch programs that seek to enlist the black domestic workers into the security apparatus. This racialized discourse of black crime not only intensifies the perception of danger and justifies strategies of enclosure, it also obscures the sources of insecurity. Violent crime is a reality in post-apartheid South Africa, but so is the disappearance of waged work, the elimination of the social safety net, the destabilization of community solidarities, and the constant presence of popular uprisings against the post-apartheid state. Neoliberal restructuring, as Claire explained, has turned millions of black South Africans into surplus populations living in conditions of extreme marginalization. Yet security discourses blame the crisis on the populations most marginalized by the transition. Black crime becomes the cause rather than an effect of insecurity and instability. In this paper, we argue that the precariousness of the poor and the insecurity of the elite in post-apartheid South Africa are produced by long histories of apartheid and by racialized neoliberalism. With the retraction of the welfare state, the appeal to individual responsibility, the dislocation of waged work, and the decomposition of class solidarities, two polarized experiences of insecurity have emerged. On the one hand, a largely disposable population, too sick to produce, too poor to consume, too needy to accommodate, has become the collateral damage of the race to the bottom. This increasingly precarious poor haunt the margins of the neoliberal city, seeking out new strategies of survival and pathways of resistance. They also serve to unsettle and unnerve the financial and symbolic security of the middle and upper classes. As Louis Boucan points out, the poor have become a living and threatening incarnation of the generalized insecurity which defines the neoliberal age. The anxieties of the elite are amplified by racialized discourses of crime and by a private security industry that fans the flames of fear. Unlike in the United States, the South African elite do not trust the state to protect them. Instead, they have withdrawn to a world of walled enclosures and private security. Everyday life in contemporary South Africa is marked by the interplay between these polarized and racialized forms of insecurity. Thanks a lot, and congratulations, Tony.
Okay, don't start the clock yet, because I have to do my Tony story. So I first met Tony when I gave a job talk here as an assistant professor, and it was, as I was thinking about this morning, I think it was actually about perceptions of communities in Detroit, Los Angeles, Boston, and Atlanta. And I think of all the faculty in the audience, Tony gave me the most trouble. And I really can't remember, fortunately, to this day, what exactly the trouble was, but I think it had something to do with Oak Park, Illinois. So I felt like I wasn't talking about Chicago, so I didn't have, you know, grounds to stand on. But anyway, he let me come to UIC anyway, and I'm very grateful for that. And he has been a great supporter and colleague through two promotions. So thank you for all of that, and thank you for including me in this wonderful conference, Tony. I do have Oak Park in this talk, so you'll be glad to know that. So I learned something, but I haven't really practiced this talk, so I don't know if you'll let me come to dinner, but I hope you will. And all the good parts of this paper are coming from my colleague and co-author on this, Mike Bader, who is going to answer all your questions and respond to your criticisms after this is over. Okay, so now you can start the clock. Chicago is a city of neighborhoods. Perhaps more than any other city in the United States, Chicago's neighborhoods cast into relief the city's identity of world-class ambitions with small-town feel. Politicians like former Mayor Richard Daley in the quote on this slide extol the virtues of neighborhoods providing unique identities to the places where ordinary Chicagoans live their everyday lives. The city's boosters highlight the uniqueness of the city's neighborhoods and the diversity of experiences one can get by traveling across them. While the mayor and city boosters extol these virtues, what they don't highlight is how little diversity there often is within each of the neighborhoods that make up the city and its surrounding suburbs. Chicago has been and continues to be one of the most segregated cities within one of the most segregated metropolitan areas in the country. While one might experience substantial diversity across the neighborhoods and communities in the metropolitan area, it's still true that most residents of the metropolitan area have neighbors that look very much like themselves. So given the lack of diversity within most neighborhoods and the unequal distribution of resources across metropolitan communities, an important question is, how do people come to live in the neighborhoods that make up this cultural landscape? How is it that ordinary residents decide to move to Uptown, Austin, or Little Village? And since the neighborhoods of Chicago make up only a small part of the communities in the metropolitan area, we must also ask how residents choose Schaumburg over Homewood or Norwood Park over Uptown or, in fact, an urban neighborhood over a suburban community. In other words, how do people sort themselves within the city and to the surrounding suburbs? To date, research examining patterns of racial residential segregation tends to focus on three explanations: racial economic disparities that reduce the purchasing power of racial and ethnic minorities relative to whites is one explanation for why people live in separate neighborhoods. Explanations based on housing preferences, racially based housing preferences, and a third is discrimination in the housing market. While these three explanations provide substantial insight into the patterns of segregation, we argue that they fall short of describing the processes that perpetuate resident racial segregation. In this presentation, we continue our earlier work, and by we, I mean Michael and I, in which we step outside these traditional theoretical traditions and provide insights into the residential searches in and perceptions that residents hold about actual communities and neighborhoods in their metropolis. We view these as a critical but often ignored component of the residential sorting process that ultimately either translates into persistent segregation or offers the potential for integration. Specifically, we answer address two separate questions. One is behavioral and one is attitudinal, both of which we think provide some insight into the residential sorting process. First, and what we emphasize almost exclusively in this talk, is an examination of where ordinary people search for housing in the Chicago metropolitan area. We think this analysis represents the first time that residential searches of specific locations among a representative sample are studied, and we think that doing so helps us understand how ordinary people find the ordinary communities, not the hypothetical facsimiles or the ideal types of those neighborhoods that are traditionally studied, has traditionally been done by myself included, so I'm criticizing myself there, in which they live their everyday lives. Given our interests ultimately in racial residential segregation, our focus is on how the race and ethnicity of the residents themselves and the race and ethnicity, the racial ethnic composition of the communities themselves shape where people search. So that's the first two research questions. And second, we also look at the communities that people cross off their list, the places they would never consider moving. Although similar in nature, this attitudinal question reveals a different and potentially important dimension of the residential mobility process. That is, to what extent do people summarily dismiss certain kinds of places or certain places from consideration, and how might this be related to the perpetuation of segregation? In order to answer these three relatively modest questions in this larger project we have about looking at how people sort themselves, we use the 2004-2005 Chicago area study, several details of which I won't go over with you in detail, but this was a random sample of Cook County residents age 21 and older. It was a face-to-face survey where interviewers went to people's doors. The interviews were conducted in either English or Spanish. We had 789 total respondents, but in this analysis, we're only looking at the 556 who had said they searched for housing in the last 10 years. These were about evenly split across whites, African Americans, and Latinos. And one part of this long interview was an exercise where we gave respondents a booklet of maps, and this is what the maps look like. There were five separate maps, and each map asked a different question. So one of the questions that we focus on in this is, in which of these 41 communities have you searched for a place to live in the last 10 years? And we also asked them, in which of these communities would you never consider living? As you can see, we did not label the 200 and some places or Chicago neighborhoods that we could have identified. We'd still be in the field interviewing if we subjected our respondents to all of that. So this is a subset. It's not a random sample of 41 communities. It was purposely selected to get a variety of racial and ethnic compositions and a variety of social class characteristics. In our analysis, we include basic descriptive statistics overall and separately for each racial and ethnic group. We also do Spearman's rank order correlation, basically to look at how blacks, whites, and Latinos compare to each other in terms of their lists, the lists of popular places to search and not popular places to search. And then we also conduct a series of logistic regression models predicting the likelihood of selecting each of the 41 different communities. So that means 41 separate dependent variables where we are predicting whether or not somebody said they would search, they had searched in that place, and whether somebody had said they would never consider searching in that place. So before you start to get up and leave, I'm not going to show you one single regression coefficient. I'm going to show you these things in maps so that it seemed to be too late in the end of a conference to do that, so don't panic. And what I'm going to show you in those regression models is I'm going to show you the effect of race on whether or not you searched in this community, and then I'm going to show you another map that illustrates, so that we're going to look at racial differences in that. I'm going to show you another map that then controls for the slew of characteristics that are listed up there that have been thought to be important in terms of how people think about where they want to live, and show you what happens essentially to the effect of race when you've controlled for a series of demographic, economic, and geographic characteristics. Okay, so question number one, where do people search for housing? So if you look at the sample overall and you ask, which communities have 10% or more of the sample saying that they've searched for a place to live in it? And this is what you get. You get seven communities that fall in that category overall. And what you see, Arlington Heights, a predominantly white suburb in the Chicago metropolitan area, was identified by 16% of the sample as somewhere that they had searched for housing in the last 10 years. And what you see with this list is you see lots of communities that are like that in the sense that they're mostly or overwhelmingly white, with the exception of Oak Park and Logan Square. But what this also glosses over completely is a broad set of differences by race and ethnicity. So that's where we're going to move next. I've broken this down again. Our sort of selection criteria was to put on this list of those 41 communities, which one had 10% or more of each racial and ethnic group searching in it. The first thing that might strike you visually from this list is the much longer list among African Americans than among whites and Latinos. Not quite twice as many. The other thing, if you don't know Chicago very well, I'll give you sort of the big picture of what kind of communities each of these three groups have searched in. So whites, two-thirds of those communities that are listed for whites are at least 70% white, if not 80 or 90% white. There are three exceptions to that. Logan Square, Uptown are two city neighborhoods, and Oak Park, which is an inner ring suburb with about 22% African American. So there's a whole lot of white communities there, in other words. Latinos, the interesting story there is that half of the communities that are on Latinos, that make it on Latinos most likely to be searched in, are the same ones that are on whites list. The other half are communities that are overwhelmingly, or not even, it's hard to find overwhelmingly, but significant Latino populations, like Pilsen, Little Village, Cicero, Berwyn, and the like. So that's an interesting observation. The third observation is that African Americans communities is a longer list, and it has, to be sure, far more predominantly or mostly African American communities on it that are absent from the first two lists, but it also includes places like Oak Park, Beverly, that are racially mixed, black and white, but nevertheless majority white, and there also includes overwhelmingly white communities or quite white communities like Schaumburg, Skokie, and Oaklawn. So that's the message from that. A sort of general message, if you look at the entire list for each of these three groups, and like I said before, we calculate a rank order correlation to see whose lists look like each other. Whites and Latinos have a very robust correlation of 0.61, so their lists look very alike. Whites and blacks, Latinos and blacks, are actually negatively correlated. They're not statistically significantly so, but they certainly are not similar lists. Question number two. Even a casual observer will point out that the demographic, economic, and geographic characteristics of our three groups are quite distinct from each other. And so what happens if we control for those characteristics and then look at search locations? So to do this, we have created maps to show you. Again, these are the regression coefficients that have been reduced to maps. So let me show you the sort of picture for those of you who aren't familiar with the landscape of Chicago. The blue that you see on the map, the more intense the blue, the higher percentage of. Very good. You know your geography and you know your Chicago segregation patterns. The greater, the higher the percentage, or the greater the intensity of red, the higher percentage of Latinos. So that gives you kind of the picture, and what I'm going to lay over it, I'm going to identify the communities in the logistic regressions where race mattered or didn't matter in terms of who searched in these communities. I'll just show you the picture and you'll get the story better. First one is the baseline, so no controls. This is a baseline model with just race, ethnicity in the equation. And here, where you see outlines for neighborhoods that don't have any color, that's where there's no racial or ethnic difference. Where you see yellow is where whites are more likely to search than African Americans, and where you see blue is where African Americans are more likely to search than whites. So what you see, there are 20 of the 41 communities where there's no racial difference in whether you'll search there or not. You find three yellow communities, Arlington Heights, Norwood Park, and Logan Square, where whites are more likely to search than African Americans. There are fully 18 communities where blacks are more likely to search than whites, and those communities are a range of places, including some that are only all or mostly black, but also lots that are racially mixed, and some that are all or mostly white. What happens when you control for demographic differences? There's no more yellow. Okay, so there are no more places where whites are more likely to search than African Americans, which is saying quite a bit when you're talking about in this pool, there are 9 or 10 communities that are all or mostly white. Six of the places, which you may not have discerned, that were dark blue, in other words, blacks were more likely to search than whites, are no longer that way. These include places like Austin, Hillston, Little Village, Beverly, Morgan Park. They're now equally likely to be searched in by whites and African Americans. So there are a range of different community types where controlling for these demographic characteristics eliminates the greater likelihood that African Americans were than whites to search in the communities. And there are now three mostly white or all white places, Arlington Heights, Schaumburg, and Skokie, where blacks are now actually more likely to search than whites once you control for background characteristics. Baseline differences comparing, now we're comparing whites with Latinos. The story here, 27 of the 41 communities, there's no difference between whether Latinos or whites have looked in the community. There's still no yellow. There are no communities where whites are more likely than Latinos to have searched. And Latinos are more likely than whites to have searched in heavily African-American neighborhoods until you control for background characteristics. Okay, let me show you that comparison. From here to here, almost all of the red have disappeared. So once you control for background characteristics, Latinos look very much more like whites. The only two communities that are the exceptions are two heavily Latino communities of Cicero and Berwyn, and then the largely thus far inexplicable to me, Madison, is included in that as well. So a lot of the differences between whites and Latinos disappear after you control for background characteristics. Now comparing African Americans and Latinos, 26 of the 41 communities show no differences between blacks and Latinos. Of the 15 where there are differences, the ones marked in blue, there are 8, have blacks more likely to search than Latinos, and there are a range of racially mixed and predominantly black communities. In 7, those marked in red, Latinos are more likely to search an African American, and many of these neighborhoods are neighborhoods with significant Latino populations like Pilsen, Little Village, Cicero, Berwyn, and Humboldt Park, but also heavily white places like Norwood Park and Lakeview. Put in the controls. Once we introduce controls, many communities that showed no difference before now do so. Blacks are now more likely to search in all or mostly black communities like Austin, Bronzeville, Olympia Fields, and Harvey. And the several communities that Latinos are more likely than blacks to search in disappear. Only Cicero and Berwyn are left as significant, where Latinos are more likely to search than African Americans. And if you know anything about the history of Cicero and Berwyn, it's likely to be higher among Latinos because that they're heavily Latino communities, and it's likely to be suppressed among African Americans because they have both of those communities have a very visible racial history that makes it such that African Americans would not feel welcome in that community. Number three, research question number two. How does race and ethnicity of the resident and of the community shape where people will never consider searching? I want to very briefly turn to this question of what is in some ways the opposite question. Instead of asking where people have searched, we're asking where would they never search. So this is a, they just checked the boxes off. I'd never consider living there. I just want to highlight a couple of things in the interest of keeping this within some time constraints. The first observation is that there are just two communities that make it on the top 10 list. We did a different approach here because we had a higher prevalence levels. We picked the highest, most likely to be picked as never considered for each of the three racial and ethnic groups. So it's the top 10 in quotes because there were ties, so it's actually the top 12-ish or something in some cases. So there are just two communities that all groups agree are not good places to live, Harvey and Cicero. But what's interesting about it is that all three groups don't like those communities, but whites really don't like those communities, right? Harvey, 84% of whites check off Harvey as a place they would never consider living, compared to just 41% of Latinos and 48% of African Americans. So it's in the top for all three groups, but the level of exclusion, and that carries through the whole pattern of results. If you look at the bottom, I've shown the range of percentages. For whites, it ranges from 66 to 84% who say they would never consider in their top 10, and it's much smaller number in among African Americans and Latinos, and it's a smaller range. So the message here is really that you're seeing there are lots of places that people just rule out of hand, and whites do so to a greater extent than African Americans and Latinos. I could tell the other story with the maps and everything, but really the story is quite consistent with what I showed you about searching in terms of the kinds of places people never consider and the what happens when you control for various characteristics. So by way of conclusions, race and ethnicity substantially differentiates where people search and where they would never consider moving. Generally similar patterns between search and exclusion, search and where you'd never consider, but much higher levels of exclusion suggest that exclusion is a key dynamic to understand in the residential sorting process. We have to understand as much about where people eliminate on their list as about where they search. The general patterns by race and ethnicity, whites are the most restrictive in where they search and the most expansive in where they exclude. African Americans consider more places overall and a greater diversity of places. At the same time, they cross far fewer places off of their list and cross off a variety of different kinds of places. Latinos are in some ways the most complicated. They search in the fewest places and exclude the small set of places, but once controls for demographics and distance are included, their search behaviors and perceptions look very much like whites. A set of conclusions that relate to place argue that rather than just look at individuals, it's important to examine places as a level of analysis, especially in light of growing research on neighborhood effects being linked to residential mobility. White communities, at least some, are heavily searched by all three groups. Simultaneously, they are very seldom excluded from consideration. Conversely, Black and Latino communities are avoided by all racial and ethnic groups, though to varying degrees, and this is especially true of African American communities. And finally, as Mike and I move forward on this research, we're following this thread. We're going to look more closely at questions like how do residents find out about communities to search in? That is, how do they decide to keep it on their list? What are the roles of friends and kin networks, for example? Followed by how do residents then decide to where to actually do the search? And then once they search there, what are the barriers of, what differentiates between successful and unsuccessful searches? And I'll end there. Thank you.